Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for traditional exercise like weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447, Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, November 28th, 2012, and this is KBIA's Views of the News, a weekly discussion of the news media's performance. I'm Mike McKean, director of the Futures Lab at the Reynolds Journalism Institute, and with me in the RJI studio are Views regulars and Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Lee Wilkins and Charles Davis. Two of our stories this week involve local controversies surrounding Mizzou sports, and a third comes to us from a loyal listener in Kirksville. MU basketball player Michael Dixon has been accused but not charged with rape. The Columbia Tribune has detailed allegations from the police investigation. Some other media are linking to the Trib without independent verification. A St. Louis television station is the latest to get caught spreading false rumors from the internet about a Missouri coach. A British judge is set to release his report on media standards and ethics in the wake of the News Corp phone hacking scandal. We highlight two instances of journalistic excellence involving the use of so-called big data, and KBIA News hopes to turn rural Missouri into a drone zone. Well, let's start with the disturbing details reported yesterday by the Columbia Tribune, confirming why MU basketball star Michael Dixon has been suspended by the coach back in October. A University of Missouri sophomore has accused Dixon of rape, though the Boone County Prosecuting Attorney's Office decided a week and a half ago there wasn't enough evidence to charge him. Well, Lee, the details are awfully gritty. They go into the types of sex the victim was forced into versus what she might or might not have consented to, the complicated nature of their relationship, evidence that was seized, the text messages exchanged between them. First of all, just your reaction to the story as it's been reported in the Tribune, not necessarily the level of detail that we're seeing in other media so far.
Well, my reaction to the story as it's been reported in the Tribune is it's about time that we found out about this. In some senses, since, for example, one of the details that's in the Tribune is that this has already been through the appropriate university committee and through it several months ago. It's interesting to me that it's waited actually this long to become much more public as it has in the Trib. I suppose that there are people who are going to object to the level of detail. Quite frankly, since there have been no charges brought, it seems that some of that level of detail maybe was necessary to try to help people understand why no charges might have been one potential. I'm not lobbying for one or the other, but one potential response to this.
Charles, apparently so far, none of the other media, with the exception perhaps of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, has actually gotten their hands on the police report, or at least several news organizations, I think of the Missouri Net, the Maneater, and others, have linked to the Tribune story without doing their own or being able to do their own independent verification so far, while others like the Missouri and the Kansas City Star have decided not to link to those details because they haven't confirmed them. Which is the right call there?
Well, I think when you haven't done your own independent reporting, linking out is fine. I mean, to me, it seems obviously transparent to say, well, here's what the Tribune has reported based on the police report. It's not changing the reporting or adding or subtracting to it. You know, it's literally just linking helpfully to it. That having been said, a couple of points. One, kudos to the Tribune for filing the public records request that generated the police report. Why that didn't dawn on anybody else is sort of baffling. The university, of course, which has been pilloried in some online comments, apparently people don't understand that the university's hands, when it comes to this particular athlete, are bound by federal privacy laws. The university just simply, by law, could not go there. Right. And is unfortunately being pilloried for that fact.
I wonder, now, the Post-Dispatch is in this interesting position because in a column written by Vahe Gregorian, one of their leading sport reporters, they did get the police report, apparently. I mean, they make reference to the police report, but they don't actually quote anything from it the way the Tribune did. And I just, in fact, they also reference, though, the fact that apparently the police interviewed some of the woman's roommates, something the Tribune did not mention in its reporting. So I just wonder what we make of the fact that the Post-Dispatch, one, didn't report anything from the police report, and that the Tribune didn't quote the roommates.
Well, they did. I mean, they did quote things from the police report, but not the same things that the Tribune did. You almost have to read the Post-Dispatch Gregorian column beside the Tribune day turn story and look for these little gaps, like the interviewing of the roommates, which didn't appear in the Tribune story. I'm not exactly sure why the Post-Dispatch didn't do a standalone news story on it. It'd be interesting to get their take on that. I mean, they just did a column. On the other hand, it would be interesting to get the Tribune's take on why the need for such incredible granular detail out of the police reports. Because I thought they could have come up a little higher.
I wonder about that part of it, Lee. And again, we don't know the circumstances. We only know what has been in the media report so far. But what about fairness to Michael Dixon? I mean, he was not charged with a crime. And as with many rape cases, accused rape cases, the accuser's name is not mentioned. And yet she's given the forum to make some extremely detailed and damaging grievances against this young man. I assume he has not responded except for one sort of lash out on Twitter, "I'm innocent," probably because the university and the athletic department are keeping him from defending himself publicly. So is it fair to him?
This is really hard because the usual thing that gets brought up in cases of rape is, well, what if the charges are erroneously brought? So I need to remind our listeners of something I remind everybody of about once every 6 months, which is that of most rapes are never reported. Of the rapes that are reported, an infinitesimally small number turn out to be erroneous reports, okay? Although Michael Dixon is absolutely not guilty until proven otherwise, for me at least, and based on the statistics, there is some weight behind the initial charges. It's a crime that occurs generally, but not always, horrifyingly, between two people. There is a level of privacy there. I bet that there are many people who know who the young woman is. It's just I don't need to know who she is when I go to the supermarket. No. And so there's a difference there. I also want to say one thing about Charles. This is a place where he and I disagree. I think linking to the Trib stuff in some ways is pretty cowardly. It's a way of saying, oh, well, they've got all the really granular, read explicit details. We're not going to get our hands dirty with that, so we're just going to link to them. My response is go do your own work.
Yeah, I mean, my temptation was actually to say at least the Missourian didn't, I mean, they didn't run the link. They didn't do the link. I assume they're doing their own investigation, but don't pull both ends of the thing. Say, I'm not going to show you the details, or I don't have the details, but I'll let you read them from somebody else. Yeah. I have a little bit of a problem with that. Now, Charles, it's unclear to me, and I guess it's unclear to everybody, of course, what actual punishment Dixon has received so far from the University Student Conduct Committee, or how or whether Chancellor Deaton's going to respond to this, given the lack of criminal charges. But clearly, that's a story we need to keep following.
Well, and this is where assumptions can get really dangerous in reporting, and I talk to my students a lot about the danger of assumptions, and this is one major one, I think, in all of these stories, is the assumption that Mr. Dixon is suspended from the basketball team for this. Mm-hmm. That's a dangerous assumption.
Yeah.
Because it could be any number of things, and we don't know, so we can't say.
What stories do you expect and hope that the media are going to continue to pursue with this, Lee?
Well, the one that we're not going to get because of the way the university works is I would actually like to know what the Student Conduct Committee has recommended. We'll never know. It's part of the process. But I think that would be not just tantalizing information, but it's good information for the rest of the campus to know. Athletes in some ways are treated differently. And I think it would be nice to know what those some ways include and whether or not the Student Conduct Committee is one of them. I certainly think that we want to know what the resolution of this case is. I would certainly like to hear from Coach Haith about, you know, what he sees, because we say that Dixon has paid no penalty. He's paying a penalty for something that's keeping him off the court. And whether that's this particular thing or something else that's gone on, I think that we need some answers about that.
Yeah.
I found a fascinating angle to this story, Charles, the fact that Twitter was involved in it in so many ways. I mean, we had former MU star Kim English, who's defending Dixon on Twitter and calling on Chancellor Deaton to overturn whatever punishment he received. We're seeing Dixon himself with kind of just one little post on Twitter, "I'm not guilty." And then we even have the accuser herself going on to Twitter to say, "I'm the one who accused him. This is what he did. This is why he's being punished." All those tweets, of course, have since been removed, but I think it's fascinating.
Oh, it's been so interesting to watch. I mean, Kimmy English sort of started the whole thing in many ways. He's like the uncool guy who graduates from college but can't quite leave. He's still, you know, kind of hanging out on Twitter there.
Well, you know, there was a focus, at least on some of the more sports-oriented media, I think of the Bleacher Report. We've got a link to that on our blog today, which basically gives pretty short shrift to the allegations themselves and focuses instead on sort of the potential season-changing impact on the basketball team. I guess that's not terribly surprising.
I don't think it's surprising. I was when we knew that we were going to be talking about this, one of the things I was going to say is to folks at home, when you sit down to read that Tribune report, if you have children which are of the appropriate age, read it with them. There's a wonderful set of teachable moments there, regardless of whether of what gender your kids are or anything else, about appropriate and inappropriate relationships and what no really means and all the rest of that sort of stuff.
Well, another MU sports celebrity made news this past week as well, football coach Gary Pinkel, not obviously for the same kinds of things. St. Louis TV station KMOV became the latest mainstream media operation that had to essentially retract a story based on internet rumors that Pinkel might be fired for his team's poor performance in their first season in the SEC. Here's how the coach reacted when asked about it by rival station KSDK.
I get off a plane on Sunday. I'm hearing all this stuff about Gary Pinkel's going to resign this week. When did you find out you were resigning?
Well, I heard about that from my daughter the night, I think Sunday night. So, no, not at all. I love what I do. I have 5 years left of my contract. I have a responsibility here. You know, I was given this opportunity in 2001. And, you know, prior to this year, we've been winning at a pretty high level nationally. We're top 15 in the nation in bowls and winning, and even including this year. But, you know, excited about getting back to work and getting back to our winning ways.
And yesterday, athletic director Mike Alden officially stood up for Pinkel, so the rumor is squelched. And I just wonder again, and this isn't the first time this has happened, Charles, obviously, but should KMOV reporter J.J. Bailey, who is an MU J-School alum, have run with an anonymous source, even one who he says is typically reliable, from the fan website Tiger Board?
Oh, I wish you hadn't mentioned that J-School alum thing. I didn't know that. I would like to talk to young Mr. Bailey and explain to him what a live source is, because there was one right there that he could have contacted. If he hadn't contacted him, then no, he could not. You cannot, based on internet rumor, report that any human being is going to do anything without having confronted said human being. Bottom line, end of story. This is journalism. This isn't even journalism 101. This is journalism 91.
I thought that it was really suspect that he would go with that source when the source, him or herself, was saying on Tiger Board that he or she didn't personally believe that Pinkel was in any danger, that this is what he was hearing. Well, Lee, this is not the first such incident. KOMU, for example, used an internet source to report a little more than a year ago that MU was going to hire the Purdue coach to handle our basketball program. When are we going to learn, and what should we be learning?
So back to our previous conversation, it's called Do Your Own Work. Do Your Own Work applies in many venues. This is another one. Do your own work. When are we going to learn? We apparently, especially in sports, have a very flat learning curve about this. And I say this with a little bit of humor, because as this giant Denver Broncos fan, I too was the recipient of many message boards and this, that, and the other thing when the Broncos first they were, and then they weren't, and then they were, and then they were again going to hire Peyton Manning. I mean, so there's something about sports that I think we sort of check our brains in some closet or the other and don't bring them out again for a while.
Does the public discount sports reporting to the point, Charles, where they don't even hold the news organization responsible? It does no damage to their reputation if they do something like this?
Oh, I think it does. I mean, I think it begins to lower sports reporting into sports internet chat boards. And we're trying to make ourselves distinct and separate in our news gathering processes from the gutter.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, I think that the media outlets that cover sports and that have their reputation to throw behind it, which is not to say that they don't sometimes get things wrong, they do, but places like, you know, Sports Illustrated and their website and, you know, so forth and so on, this is a reputation that's built over years and years and years of doing it right. And when you're just starting out, like these grads, recent grads are, this is not the time to be making these kinds of errors.
Well, and we have some non-recent grads who made some big errors in journalism in Great Britain, and we may see what the fallout of all that is tomorrow, because it promises to be a really big day there.
Not our grads.
Not our grads in this instance.
I was worried.
I don't think. But Judge Brian Levison is scheduled to release his long-awaited report on media standards, culture, and ethics. And the Levison Inquiry, as it's called, has been following on the News Corp phone hacking scandal, and also the recent resignation of the BBC's director general in the wake of that false report they ran that a former member of the British government was involved in child sexual abuse. So there's quite a bit of speculation, Charles, in the press and elsewhere over what recommendations Judge Levison might make. Is he going to call for new tough sanctions and standards and regulations? Will Parliament go along with him if he does? Or will he conclude, as some members of the media at least hope, that the rest of the media shouldn't be tarred with what News Corp did in the past? What do you think might be the more logical outcomes of that inquiry?
I'm wary. I've read some things early this morning, in fact, that seemed to indicate that he was moving toward a much broader statutory regulatory regime on the press. And the frightening thing about that is he's got a lot of popular support for it. I mean, it's been a rough few months for the press in the UK. And as a result, if a politician senses sort of that the political wind is at his back, I think they could really go to town here. So I'm concerned, and I'm watching it very warily.
Yeah, Lee, and it isn't just News Corp anymore. I mean, with the BBC revelations, you know, not just with the case we just talked about, but of course also with their host and the cover-up of the documentary and all of that. I mean, who's to say that there shouldn't be some sort of overarching report and maybe some new regulations on the media?
Well, I think it depends on what kind of regulations you want to have. I'm assuming, but perhaps very incorrectly, that he's going to have some things to say about the British Press Complaints Commission, which we actually don't have a parallel of in this country, and which, well, the FCC might be the parallel, but basically has been compromised out in so many, many, many ways. To say that body specifically needs to be redone and to give it some powers that would at least force media organizations to support it financially, I think those might be welcome. And I don't know that those necessarily sound like censorship or anything like that to me.
Well, should it be a private sector bulking up of the Press Complaints Commission, which is basically saying they're going out of business because they really didn't do their job? Or should there be some independent body with the power to impose meaningful sanctions on journalists and organizations that do what News Corp did?
Well, I mean, clearly there's a big distinction here between self-regulatory regimes and government regulatory regimes. Yep. And the early indications this morning, some of these indicated that they might have been able to peek at least at the Levison report, and they seem to indicate that there was a real move towards some sort of statutory regulatory regime, which is really disturbing.
Well, also tomorrow, interestingly enough, also in Europe, there's a strike that's going to be going on. Journalists in Italy, they're protesting a proposed law there that would send writers who are convicted of defamation to jail while apparently letting editors off with a fine. First, Lee, I mean, a reaction to that proposal. And second, more broadly, talk a little bit about the differences between European notions of press regulation and ours in the U.S.
Okay, well, so broadly, I mean, my editor should not get off scot-free. I'm sorry. That's wrong on so many levels. The distinctions can be boiled down, or at least the core of them can be boiled down, I think, to two things. The first is our First Amendment, where it says Congress shall make no law. And that's the People's Amendment. That's the Citizenry's Amendment. But we in the media have gotten a great deal of latitude and protection from it since the Bill of Rights was passed. So that's the first thing. The second thing is that, especially on the continent, European law works kind of differently. It's not this sort of adversary system that we're used to. You sort of have a person who's in, I think, in both France and Italy, actually technically called a judge. That's the translation, who serves as what we would kind of call the investigating prosecutor. So it's a little bit of police function, a little bit of prosecutorial function, and that person essentially comes up with whatever the charges are going to be. So it's a very different way of kind of ferreting out the truth. And I'm not saying that it's bad. I'm just saying it's different than what we're used to.
Yeah. Well, Charles, another interesting side issue has emerged from the BBC's troubles in all of this, and that's that a former government official, that one we talked about earlier, who was wrongly accused of child abuse, is now threatening to sue some high-profile citizens on Twitter who've been passing along the BBC's report. And he's also suggested, I thought this was interesting, that those with fewer than 500 Twitter followers simply apologize in writing and send some sort of appropriate donation to charity. Apparently in Great Britain, you can be sued for defamation just for posting someone else's false account on the internet.
Yep. Yeah, you can be held liable even if you're just a conduit of information. And I think his lawyers are sort of sensing a sort of political advantage here and exploiting it. It'll be interesting to see how much is too much here.
Yeah. Well, our next story comes to us via a note from Kirksville, a listener there, Arthur Freeland. Dr. Freeland was interested in the efforts that were taken by an investigative journalist and his students to track potential conflicts of interest between physicians, drug companies, and the agencies that are charged with regulating their behavior. And Lee, this report is found in the December issue of Scientific American. We've got the link to the full story. It's a detailed, lengthy piece. Plus, we have a link to the actual description by the journalist of what he and his students went through to get the story. Basically, Charles Seif was teaching an investigative reporting course at NYU a year ago spring. He decided he was going to follow up on a very successful piece that he and others had done called Dollars for Docs. It was a database collaboration with ProPublica, NPR, and some other folks. And so the students were looking at and cleaning up the databases involved with drug company payments to medical researchers and whether the researchers, when they applied for grants from the National Institutes of Health, were disclosing, as they're required to, any such payments that might be seen as potential conflicts of interest. Well, he ran into some stonewalling basically everywhere he went, despite some stern and well-crafted FOI requests at the state and federal level. He had to sue eventually, and even when he did do that and he won, the NIH was allowed to keep secret some documents that apparently would have proved valuable in making the case he was trying to make. And this was the gist, I think, you tell me if I'm wrong, of the reporting that they did. A lengthy story, read it yourself. But basically he found that the drug company money was undermining and potentially biasing medical research in some ways that, you know, do harm to the public, and that the most likely solution to this problem, the reporters felt, was not going to come from the federal regulatory agencies, but from the scientific community itself, and especially from the journals that publish some of this research. You think that's going to work?
Well, first, people, especially who listen to this show, really should take a look at this story because it's applicable to every single university that does medical research, which means it's applicable here. And by that, I do not mean that drug companies are tarnishing research here at MU. I mean that it spells out the sort of things that can happen. And secondly, I think that they placed way more credence in the clout that scientific journals have. So let me give you a couple of reasons. One, these are for-profit enterprises. In fact, they're hugely profitable. Just ask our library acquisitions department. Secondly, there's so much money at stake. And to expect the journals to police universities, that's an unequal power relationship of pretty much first orders of magnitude. I'm really not sure who's going to clean up this problem because there's a great deal of incentive for everybody to sort of keep it the way it is. And, of course, the only people who get hurt are those of us who take prescription medications.
Well, Charles, so they may or may not have been right ultimately in the conclusions they drew, but I think we can all agree that this sort of big data journalism, as we call it, digging through databases and all of that, is a new frontier for journalists. It's really producing some results that are very important for the public. You brought to our attention another story, maybe a little bit less demanding story, but from ProPublica this week. They apparently used documents and records from federal agencies in Europe to prove that Russia has been printing and sending tons and tons of cash to Syria. So what do we make of the efforts, the techniques used by these journalists?
That was without question. I thought the most important story of the week. That story was fascinating.
Yeah.
The fact that Russia is basically propping Syria up through literally plane loads of cash.
200 tons of bills. Yeah.
It was a fascinating story. And the methodology of the story, which is spelled out within the link that we've got on the blog, take a look at it. It's just, to me, just the state of the art of reporting.
They used international plane tracking services because the governments of Syria and Russia were not collaborating. Photos of the planes from aviation enthusiasts, air traffic control audio recordings. I mean, it's quite a sensational story. Well, we started this week's program with a couple of local stories, and so let's also end with one. KBIA has announced that it's receiving a $25,000 grant from the university to experiment with rural news coverage using drones. No, not those big ones that the U.S. government uses to target terrorists. The relatively inexpensive remote-controlled mini helicopters that can carry a small still or video camera out into the sky. KBIA producer Scott Pham is going to work with colleagues from the College of Engineering and students from one of my classes to build these drones and test them in a variety of news situations. Scott says he got the idea while covering the breach of a Mississippi River levee last fall. And for those of you who are watching the video of our show, here's an example of what's possible from the University of Nebraska's drone journalism lab.
Nebraska is facing record-breaking drought, the likes of which have not been seen since the Dust Bowl of the Great Depression. On the ground, dried-out plants and dead lawns show the impact of drought. In the sky, a drone offers a different drought perspective. The Platte River, which runs across the middle of the state, has become a long sandbar, braided by streams.
So these eyes in the sky, these relatively cheap drones, can replace, you know, high-priced airplanes or helicopters. They can take journalists places they couldn't ordinarily go. But I wonder, Charles, do you see this drone journalism as a fad, or does it have real potential to improve our storytelling?
Oh, no, I think it has very real potential, and in ways that we can't really even envision yet. It also has great legal and ethical peril, particularly when you're dealing with private property. But the folks that are doing this are taking great caution to think about it in terms of public lands. And one of the things that we were kicking around, some of the drone students and I just the other day, I mean, the way you can survey topographically areas can do so much with regard to conservation stories and water stories.
And traffic and protests in urban areas and weather coverage, lots of things you can do with them. But Lee, and we just have a few moments to talk about them, but say just a word or two about some of the privacy and security and safety issues involved
here. It's no different than the privacy questions that Google Maps is facing. You send the drone over me in my backyard when I'm out sunbathing in my bikini. I don't have a bikini. You've got real privacy issues. At the same time, I agree with Charles. I mean, I would like for us to send our little drone down the Mississippi and down the Missouri because we already know that those rivers are at historic lows. There's a way to tell that story visually that I think will help the words and will help the impact of the story itself.
One of the problems, of course, at the moment is the FAA doesn't have any sort of regulatory scheme in place on whether and when to allow these drones, especially in urban areas where they could cause safety problems, not to mention all the issues with privacy and government security and all of that. And so that's one of the reasons why we here at KBIA are going to be focusing on rural coverage for the time being, so we can skirt some of those issues while we're trying to see whether or not these tools can really work. Well, that's where we're going to have to leave it for this week. Thanks for listening, watching, and sending in your suggestions. You can find streaming audio and video of our program, along with links related to our topics, at kbia.org under the Talk Shows tab. Just look for Views of the News. And we welcome your comments anytime at views@kbia.org. Behind the scenes, our show is produced and directed by RJI's Travis McMillan and KBIA's Pat Akers. I'm Mike McKean. Please join Lee and me and Charles next Wednesday for another edition of KBIA's Views of the News.